Podcast is always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, September the 10th, 2026, and this is going to be episode 3898 of the Survival Podcast. Being that it is a Thursday, it will be an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I got a lot to cover with you guys today. I got a good lineup of the experts on a wide variety of topics. First up, we'll have Dr. Paul. That's Dr. Ron Paul, if you're new around here, and Chris Rossini. They're going to talk about how our empire is on autopilot and starts wars constantly. The autopilot is the part that interests me more, and it's why I say that the people you put in office do not really affect the macro of the direction that the country goes. And I think they affect a lot of things, but not the macro. And I'll explain that with some follow-up on their segment. Then Jesse Markowitz will talk about the difference between UNRAID and START 9 for digital sovereignty. Andy McCann will talk about training for grandparents to keep up with grandkids. I'll have a few thoughts on that one myself. Joel Alton, MD, also known as the illustrious Doc Bones, we'll talk about using nicotine as a home remedy. It will not be an advocation for smoking at all, but nicotine is an active plant substance, a drug, and therefore it has certain therapeutic qualities to it. Kerry Brown will talk about choosing a wood splitter. Then I actually have two segments for you today. I have my typical segment, kind of a longer one, and my segment today is called Why Fault and Responsibility Are Different and Why That Matters. And then I have a new series coming out for you. We're going back to 5 shows a week, but I'm not going to be working real hard again on those Friday shows. We're going to be doing something called Friday Fusions, which will be a fusion of my prompting ability and the AI entities at Notebook LM, now known as Gemini Notebook. If you just rolled your eyes, don't. I think when you hear what comes out tomorrow, it will blow you away. I'll tell you all about it as we wrap up today. Now, before we go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini, I want to remind you of two things that are coming up really, really fast, one faster than the next. On Monday morning, that's the 14th at 9 a.m., we are dropping the new AI-driven course, How to Find the Business That's Right for You, with you being the key part of this. In this course, we are not just coming up with a bunch of business ideas. That's not what this is about. We are not going to say, here's like the 40 trendy business. This has nothing to do with what's trendy or what somebody else thinks about business. The first thing we do is analyze you, the founder, for strengths and weaknesses. Then we analyze the businesses. Then we do what's called red team both of them, find reasons to eliminate them. And then we build a 60-day launch plan. We do all that in 15 days, working about 20 to 30 minutes a day. And it is a self-led course. You control how fast you move through it. We've designed it ideally to start on a Monday and end on a Friday, 3 weeks in a row with weekends to think. You can work faster if you want to. But whatever day you sign up, you will start that next Monday. It'll give you time to do the part we call get ready to get ready, which might be some of the most time-consuming portion of it, so you can use that buffer time. The big thing, when we launch on Monday, you don't have to worry about it selling out. This course will be an evergreen product. You'll be able to buy it whenever you want to. But the first 100, you're going to get the course for $69. The next 100, 101 to 200, you will get the course for $79. And then everybody after that will pay the full price of $99. So we're just giving you an incentive. This is kind of a new thing from us, these types of courses that are kind of one-off instead of instructor-led. So there you go. Now, next Saturday, not this Saturday, next Saturday, the 19th at 9 a.m. Central Time, the tickets for the fall workshop go on sale. I put out a lot about it this week, so I'll just remind you of the time. 9 a.m., September 19th. That's Central Time. I'm going to tell you the interest this year is high. The number of people asking me questions, when does it go on sale? What's it going to be about? Who's going to be there? Can I come with it? You know, can I bring this or that? Is very high, higher than the past couple years. So it's going to sell out. I can tell just by the vibrations in the ground. So if you want to be there and not be square, then you need to be ready 9 a.m., be on the Telegram group or channel. That's where I'll drop the link first. If it makes it about 10 minutes, I'll put it out on social media, the website, etc. All right, With that, let's dig on into it. Let's start off with talking about how our empire is on autopilot with Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul.
No deals out there right now. I'll tell you what, there is a report now that we want to talk about, and it's just a token report because they talk about the price of oil and gasoline in the United States. But the article in the Independent, the title is, Iran War is Costing Americans $100 billion in extra energy costs. Of course, $100 billion, it's not much these days. They talk about trillions and trillions of dollars of AI. But they must not have had AI out there warning them, you know, you're not going to have any money left pretty soon if you don't stop. I don't know whether AI will protect us against inflation. But so far, I would say nobody's protecting us against debt and inflation. And that's what we have to deal with.
Yes, after trillions gone on Middle East wars that were not for us, obviously, we gained no benefit. And hundreds of billions in Ukraine, once again, what does Ukraine have to do with us? Now we're, the American people are $100 billion in extra energy costs. And we all feel it. I feel that money gone. And this is the foreign policy philosophy is destroying our country. Not only is America not going to rule the world militarily, it's proving that it cannot, but it's destroying us in the process because they won't stop. And there's a very big disconnect between Washington and the American people, and it's a long-term disconnect. I remember 25 years ago, George W. Bush, we're going to have a humble foreign policy. We're not going to go try to remake other countries. That's crazy. And then after him came Mr. Hope and Change, Obama, who got a Nobel Peace Prize and then bombed, what, 8 countries? And then, of course, the latest one with Make America Great Again. So there's a very big disconnect because the American people for at least almost 30 years have been voting against this stuff. But D.C. does not care. They will tell us the words we want to hear just to get votes and make it feel like we have some kind of stake in this. But then they go and do whatever they want, so they don't really care what we think. And this war is even proof. We didn't even have to be tricked into this one because there was very little propaganda. They just went ahead and did it. And Tulsi Gabbard, director of national intelligence. So even the intelligence community was telling the president that this, don't do this. Did it anyway. So this was happening regardless of what the intelligence community said, what the American people want. It's just they're on autopilot, and this is very dangerous for our nation.
So I'm going to set the politics aside here because this is all angled from look how much money Trump spent. And I'm going to tell you, and this is no defense of Trump whatsoever, but why I don't really care. Because if it was somebody else, there would be just as much money spent maybe on different things. And it is because we are on autopilot. And that's the part I don't want you to gloss over with what Chris and Dr. Paul had to say. We are going to spend trillions more dollars every year on senseless bullshit because two things. One, that's what government does. And two, the system we are in requires it. We are in a system where all new money is debt. And new money must be printed to fund the existing debt. Those are hardwired in, and it's why when any politician tells you anything about cutting the deficit, balancing the budget, whatever, they are lying through their teeth, even if when they say it, they think they're telling you the truth. They are either lying, or they are so willfully ignorant to how our system works, they do not understand that they are lying, which I believe many people running for Congress, the Senate, etc., especially kind of what you would call political versions, their first shot at it, they actually don't know. I do still consider it willful ignorance because it's not hard to find out if you want to find out. Our government will spend trillions more in a few years than they'll spend this year. I guarantee it. I told you where the national debt would be, where it is right now at $40 trillion by 2025 to 2026. I said that the first time in 2010, and people told me I was smoking crack, and if it happened, we would be immediately, you know, in the total collapse of society, streets on fire, Patriots the coming collapse from James Wesley Rawls, et cetera, ad nauseum. And I said, no, it's a slow spiral to death, not a quick cliff off the edge. Okay? The only reason I would be able to know that is because, not because I'm Spirko Domus, is because math. All you have to do is look at the math. Now, did we maybe get there a little quicker and my timeline was right because of what we did during COVID? Maybe, but I don't think it's even that much true. That was just the excuse to spend the money. The money must be spent. And to spend the money, you have to print the money. So we're never going to fix this. This will eventually end with a complete dwindling away of the purchasing power of the dollar and a rebasement of the currency into something new because it doesn't have any other way out. And it probably won't end with a complete drop off of the dollar going away overnight because the rest of the world can't afford for it to happen that way. They will divest of us. They will find other ways. But in some way, some meaningful way, eventually we will have a come to Jesus moment economically, and we'll have a lot of pain and raw gnashing of teeth. And the dollar will have to be rebased on something new. There is no way out of that. So when you hear the next politician promise, we're going to do this and we're going to... No, they're not. When they say we're going to provide you all this free shit, no, they're not. By the way, I don't think Trump's going to give you the $5,000 he promised last night apparently at the convention either. That's not going to happen. We've been promised other dividends and shit. That's not coming. It's all bull. It's all bullshit. When you grow up and realize this, then you can realize that you need to be focusing on the things that you control instead of being outraged by the things that are put in front of you to make you support one mafia family, Republicans, over another mafia family, Democrats, or now we might just call them the socialists, right? I mean, that's your choice right now. You have socialist mafia and you have soft socialist mafia. That's all you've got. The Republicans are like soft socialists and like the freaking Democrats are becoming hardcore Marxist communists. Take your pick, right? And you know what? There are things that you can do to build your own resilience, and that's why we teach those. Now, let's talk about one way we can do that, and that is what we call digital sovereignty. I'm going to have Jesse Markowitz come on here in just a moment and tell you about something called Unraid versus something called Start 9 and which one works better. Before we do that real quick, since we're talking about economics here, I want to mention our sponsor of the day today is John Pugliano with the Wealth Studying Podcast. You want to tune into the Wealth Studying Podcast, guys. It's about 10 to 15 minutes, about once a week on average, and it's what John is doing with his own money and his clients' money as a wealth manager. He is a great guy, been working with us since 2010, and I want to remind you, he will be presenting along with kind of the newest member of his firm, which is Investable Wealth. That's where he does his money management side of things. His son, Joe. The two of them will be at TSP 26 workshop this November and talk to you about the investments you can be making to turn your investments into a fortress. And Joe's a great dude. You haven't heard him on the air yet. Maybe you will at some point, but you can come meet him. I met him up in Tennessee at Nicole's workshop this year. I was very impressed with him. In any event, check out thewealthstudyingpodcast.com, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. Now let's hear from Jesse Markowitz, expert panel member on all things digital, cryptocurrency, etc., on Unraid versus Start 9 for your digital sovereignty.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today I have a question from Jerry. Jerry ran Windows Home Server for years and moved to Unraid. He uses it as a media server for document backups and now Image for photos. He also has a Start9 server. Jerry asks, how do you decide what belongs on Unraid and what belongs in StartOS? He says, Unraid feels more like a file server and StartOS feels more like an application server. Jerry, I think your instinct is basically right, but I'd refine it slightly. I would call Unraid storage first and StartOS service first. Unraid starts with the storage. You configure the drives, the pools, shares, redundancy, and then run Docker containers or virtual machines on top of that. StartOS starts with a service. You install an application, and StartOS manages more of the plumbing around it, the installation, updates, networking, backups, integration with the rest of the system. But that does not mean that big data applications automatically belong on Unraid and everything else on StartOS. The question really is, how do you want to manage that service, and how much control do you want over what's underneath it? Jerry, in your case, you may prefer quite a few services on Unraid because it seems like you enjoy working with the technology. Take Image. You might want precise control over where the photo library lives, which drives or pool it uses, where the application data goes, how containers are configured, and Unraid gives you that level of control. On the other hand, consider Vault Warden. You could run Vault Warden on Unraid, but it has a small amount of data. You may not care which drive it's on or how every part of the container is configured. StartOS might be better here because it's got the graphical management interface, one-click updates, integrated networking with StartTunnel, and just might be less overhead management to worry about. So the trade-off is simple. Unraid exposes more of the machinery. StartOS manages more of that machinery for you. The same thing applies if you're going to try out new applications. If there's already a Docker container available, Unraid gives you a direct way to configure it with Docker and start experimenting with it. Again, all those options available. With StartOS, you just load and go, even for trying something out, but only for applications that are already packaged. There are 121 services already packaged in the Start 9 and community registries when I checked earlier today, and there are more arriving every week. I've packaged a number of services myself now, and while it is some extra work, it's not necessarily a major blocker. So, for home server applications, the question is, for this particular application, which management experience do I want? For folks who are listening who aren't running home services yet, think about how technical you are and how technical you want to be. If you want to start self-hosting without immediately learning Docker containers, storage mappings, ports, and all that underlying machinery, StartOS is definitely the easier place to begin. If you're already comfortable with servers, Docker, storage pools, all of that, or you're really looking to learn that stuff, then starting with Unraid makes sense. Or maybe if you have the funds and desire, be like Jerry, and why not both? So here's the quick checklist. Do I need specific storage capabilities or control over particular drives and pools? How much of the container and networking configuration do I really want to manage myself? Which interface do I prefer for this service? And if it's something I'm running already, is wherever it is already working okay? You don't want to move a perfectly good image installation just because another server could also do it. The best setup is not the one that looks nicest on a diagram. It's the one that you can understand, maintain, update, and can recover when something goes wrong. Figure out how much control you want, how much complexity you want to manage, then pick the platform that best fits what you're trying to do. One last point. I answered Jerry's question about Unraid versus StartOS, but there are other home service platforms out there too, including Umbral, TrueNAS, Archipelago, and others. These platforms are making it practical for regular people to run their own services and keep more control over their own data. This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Jerry, thanks for the question. For a more relaxed conversational take on Bitcoin, I have a new Bitcoin Pivot podcast coming out every week at thebitcoinpivot.com/podcasts. And if you want help with Start 9, a Bitcoin risk assessment, or other technology questions, just reach out.
I think the takeaway from this is that both of them are for anybody, but not necessarily everybody. And some people may want both, and some people may gravitate towards one, but both are really great and highly useful tools. All right, now next up, we're going to be hearing from Andy McCann on training for grandparents. I happen to be a grandfather, so maybe I'll have a little bit to say after we hear what Andy has to say about this. And what do you mean training for grandparents? Just geriatric exercise? No, with a purpose, being able to keep up with the grandkids. And I would say that often involves, you know, your own kids as well when you're doing family group activities.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. If you're in the Woodstock area here in Georgia, come see us, man, you survival podcast listeners. There is a couple people like us in the group with chickens and trying to live that good life even when times are bad or when they're not. Anyway, the question comes from Mike today. He said, I would like to do more things in my older age with my friends and family and the young ones and be able to keep up and enjoy it and not be a hindrance. Yes, I paraphrase because I can't read out loud. So, Mike, without telling you, probably the easiest thing to do is just go join a CrossFit gym and just do whatever they say. That'll work. I would say, if you're not into the training, like I want to go to the gym. I enjoy that. I want the long endurance. I want long time in the gym. I want to follow processes and all that. Then what I would say is do something like what Jack is doing. He has a heavy bag. He enjoys it. He does some time punching the bag and then takes a rest. And then goes back to the bag and takes a rest. There are things like Dr. Tabata came up with the Tabata system. So it's 20 seconds of work, 10 seconds off. And you can play with that sort of a scenario. So if you're doing 20 seconds, you can imagine you can go relatively hard. Of course, 10 seconds of rest, you start to fall off quickly. But the idea is intensity has a both strength and endurance corollary. So you can move with intensity and build both of those things. Is it what you specifically need? I don't know. I don't know what the problems are. So do you lack strength? Do you lack mobility? Are your joints hurting you? I would say that moving yourself, not to the point, well, maybe to the point of pain, but not like agonizing pain, like, hey, I need to push through a little bit here, is probably good. So if your hips don't want to open up, drop down into a deep squat a lot and find out, can I gain range of motion from that? So the training I would do is any type of interval style training, or I guess they came up with the term HIIT, so HIIT, high intensity interval training. I would include weightlifting. I would include some of the things that you would think of as endurance, except I wouldn't do it for a long time. So like run, bike, row, you can do them in spurts. So like 2 minutes or 4 minutes or 60 seconds. The idea is doing anything is better than nothing. Pushing beyond where you want to go will help you grow to the places you need to be. So for example, my long-term why is I want to be healthy and fit enough to coach my kids' kids in soccer when the time comes. Now, do I really care to coach them in soccer? No, it's just, you know, I need to be active and involved. I need to have my wits around me and I need to be able to be mobile and do stuff. What does that mean? It definitely doesn't mean I'm trying to create a one rep max back squat. I'm not a huge fan of going for one rep maxes. At this stage of life, I realize it's just to show off. There's not as much building power out of that as if you did something like a 5x5. Now, doing something like a 5x5 appropriately, so five sets of five reps in your back squat, let's say, should take you like 2.5 hours in the gym if you're using the hypertrophy models. Now, if you don't know what any of that means, just if you have time on your hands, yeah, go do that. That's fine. If you lack time, that's where high intensity interval training comes in. It doesn't get you strong as fast, and it doesn't get you as endurancey as fast as just going down those single routes, but it does build both, and so you'll gain that. And I'm greedy. I'm greedy with my time. I don't want to spend a lot of time doing those things. So I would mix and match things as much as you can that creativity allows to get you out of a routine and to get you away from boredom. And I would push things like, hey, where is my deep squat? I don't know. What does that even look like? How much can I lift? Can I go a little bit heavier without, obviously, don't hurt yourself? So I would aim at that. I'm always a fan of do the things that you'll do. So I know a buddy of ours from the show, Bruce Softgy, he is an endurance guy. He would ride his bike 30 minutes to Dobbins Air Force Base back and forth, right, every day. So 30 minutes there, 30 minutes back. And he loved it. I just don't like biking on the road. So if he will do it, do it. Jack is into the heavy bag. I think that's awesome. I think something like a bag is probably even better than most people would anticipate because you can go light and fast on it. You can make the intervals short. You can make them long. You can go heavy with a lot of power and slow. So there's a lot of adjustments that you can make in there. Obviously, don't hit it so hard that you break your wrists or something, but that's the angle I would go on. If you want to be able to hang out and do the things with your family that is younger and or your grandkids or whatnot and not be a burden, then you need to be able to do more, not like I'm just shaving it down. I'm just walking. I need to push more. So what do they want to do? Let's say here we've got Stone Mountain. It's a massive rock in the ground. I think it's like if you do the 3-4-5 triangle, the five side to walk up of it is about a mile. That means the three, the height of it is, I don't know, like 3/5 of a mile. So a little over half a mile, to the height. If you're doing something like that, then I would learn to hike up something a bit steeper, maybe not as long, but steeper, like maybe go to Blood Mountain and hike that. Then when you go to Stone Mountain, you're like, oh, that's pretty easy. So do something that's a bit more aggressive than the place you want to be, and your body will adapt to it. Your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. Okay, so if you're like, Andy, I don't want to do this on my own, you can hire us. We have coaches that do remote coaching. I'll hook you up directly with them. If you want nutrition advice, yeah, they will walk you down those roads from macros to habits. I mean, you name it, this is what we do. If you need me, you can find me at www.crossfitgarage.com, or you can email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. I am happy to connect you with one of my folks. Y'all take care.
I agree with everything Andy said there, but where I want to reinforce it actually also comes from something Andy has said quite a few times. I've heard him say this, especially at live presentations. What he points out is as we age, we stop doing certain things. And if you don't do a thing for long enough, then your body decides, oh, I don't need to do that thing anymore. And then you have atrophy, not necessarily muscular atrophy like a person in a coma, but your ability to do that thing and the specific little micro portions of your muscles, your tendons, your ligaments, etc., they do atrophy, at least in regard to that. In other words, your bicep may still look big, but if you stop doing something that requires fine motor motion that also involves using your bicep, so you're using your fingers, but you're using your bicep, you'll lose that ability. I'll tell you who's really aware of this is people like surgeons that have really fine motor skills with doing certain surgeries. If they don't do a certain surgery for long enough, they begin to degrade in their performance to do that surgery, even though they know exactly how to do it. What does that have to do with kids? Well, when you say you want to keep up with your kids, there's probably very specific places where you start to feel like you're falling behind. What are the things that you have to do to keep up with those kids in that moment? Do that thing. And it's probably not that complicated. It's probably not lifting a barbell over your head, though that's a good exercise and you should do that too. But it's usually keeping up with their pace because they like to run ahead and shit, and then you have to run with them. Or you go on a vacation and you're going up and down hills, and then that requires a certain level of cardiovascular health that begins to degrade if we don't use it as we age. So think about when you're with your kids and your own children, your grandchildren, when you're with your in-laws, et cetera, your daughter-in-law, son-in-law, what have you, and they're doing things, where is it that you specifically feel that they have to wait up on you? Okay? And then don't feel bad about that because, hey, we wait up on our elderly. That's what we're supposed to do. However, it makes sense for you as a lifestyle decision to try to mitigate that as best you can, because if you do that, you're going to live longer and healthier anyway. In other words, two people can both check out at 85 or 87 or 88 or 90 or 79 or whatever it is, but their last few years can be drastically different even if they die on the same exact day and they were born on the same day. And it has a lot to do with the activity levels that we keep up with. So finding ways to build that activity in your life. So what I'm saying is, that training may be as simple as walking. And here's something that happens as we age. We start to hate really cold weather and really hot weather. And so during those times of the year, and I think everybody does this, but as we age, this happens more. We stay inside. So we walk less. We do less. Find a place to go and walk. That can be one of the major things that you can do. A little bit of weight bearing while you're doing it, even better, especially for females with osteoporosis prevention by continuing to build bone density or maintain bone density. Okay. So if you have to go somewhere so that the climate is controlled so that you'll do the activity, then do that. There's nothing wrong with taking that approach. And then what to do is walk at a pace you're comfortable with and then increase that pace just a little bit. You can even do this by timing yourself. Time yourself on a lap around a mall or a lap around Home Depot or a lap around Walmart or whatever, walking at the pace that you find comfortable. Then increase that pace and take time off of it and continue to do that. I know this won't make you big and strong. I know this won't put you in super high-level athlete shape, but it is a great way to do what this person asked, keep up with the kids. Add the strength training, add the beating of the heavy bag, whatever it is, but especially to start out. See, this is the thing about walking. Anybody can do it, so go do that. And again, then compete against yourself. If it takes you 5 minutes to make that lap, whatever that lap is, start working on getting it down to 4.5. When you can get it down to 4.5 and now you're comfortable with it, you know, take it down to 4:15. If you can cut a minute, you've increased your speed by 20%. And then, you know, how many laps can you do at that speed? Something like that. And don't use my numbers. Just use the concept. All right, moving on. Let's talk about nicotine. Not an excuse to go out and burn down a couple of packs of Camel No Filters, but can nicotine be used as a remedy at home?
Hey, Joel, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way, and designer of quality medical kits at AltonFirstAid.com. Here's a question from Michael, who writes, been learning more about the power of nicotine as a home remedy for many things. Is there any truth to the claims of using nicotine? Would like to start making salves as well as taking either patches or oral nicotine. We're thinking of trying to grow some all-natural tobacco next year. Here are some things that nicotine is supposed to help with. This is what Michael writes. Cognitive enhancement, neuroprotection, and Parkinson's disease. Potential benefit in Alzheimer's disease. Anti-inflammatory properties in rheumatoid arthritis and gout. Weight management. Improved mood and antidepressant effects. ADHD symptom reduction. Ulcerative colitis relief. And reduced risk of certain cancers. Well, Michael, you certainly have heard of the dangers of lung cancer as it pertains to smoking, and indeed less people are smoking cigarettes now than maybe in the last entire century. But people smoke to get a dose of what you're talking about, which is nicotine. Nicotine is a primary attraction for people who smoke tobacco. Inhaling tobacco smoke delivers nicotine to the brain in seconds, triggering a surge of a chemical produced in the brain called dopamine that generates temporary feelings of pleasure, focus, and relaxation. Considered part of sacred rituals by certain Native American tribes, many people still use smoking as a tool to cope with stress, anxiety, or negative emotions, or maybe just due to peer pressure from friends and family. I think a lot of people know that besides nicotine, inhaled cigarette smoke contains a number of other chemical compounds, some of which can cause cancer and heart disease. But you might not know that some data does exist that suggests medicinal benefits from the use of nicotine itself in other forms, like patches, gum, or pouches. When separated from the toxic chemicals, tar and carbon monoxide inhaled by burning tobacco, isolated nicotine interacts differently with the body. While it remains a highly addictive substance with cardiovascular risks, clinical research has identified specific health benefits that deserve further research. Chief among these are, well, getting you to stop from smoking tobacco and getting exposed to cancer-causing substances. You can get your nicotine fixed by patches, gums, or pouches and not put yourself at risk for that problem. But there are other properties as well. Some have hard data supporting them, some not so much. Some scientists claim that nicotine may help protect brain cells from degeneration through its ability to activate certain receptors that produce an important chemical known as dopamine, mentioned earlier. A 2012 study indicates that nicotine has protective properties in animals' brains and might slow the progression of dementia. Also, the incidence of the serious nerve disease called Parkinson's is lower in nicotine users than the general population. It may even possibly slow the progression of tremors seen in Parkinson's disease. Also, nicotine may help manage attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. Studies from the 1990s show that nicotine may help in its management. In one study, nicotine was found to improve performance by increasing subjects' energy levels. It was found to reduce reaction time and improve concentration, which is a big problem in ADHD, as you might know. Also, it may have something to do with schizophrenia. Schizophrenia presents with cognitive problems which may be improved by the use of nicotine. The result is improved memory, better learning ability, and other functions as well. It's believed that many schizophrenics use nicotine naturally to reduce the effects of the condition by improving their mental stability. It also is possibly helpful in weight and insulin control. Nicotine has helped to control weight by reducing an individual's appetite and hunger. It may also improve blood sugar levels and insulin sensitivity, useful in those with mild to moderate diabetes. This according to studies carried out on obese mice. Also, there's some gut protection as well that may occur as a result of using nicotine. Studies have shown that nicotine prevents the occurrence of ulcerative colitis, the major cause of inflammatory bowel disease. Nicotine is in fact used in some treatments for ulcerative colitis, likely due to nicotine's effect on intestinal lining blood flow and immune responses in the gut. Less data exists for this, but nicotine has been found to help repair wounded body tissues. When applied topically, some studies suggest that nicotine stimulates growth of tissue and blood capillaries within the affected areas. It increases blood flow to the wound and repairs the damaged blood vessels, and that speeds healing. Other reported benefits of nicotine with limited evidence to support it include improvement with canker sores, uterine fibroids, uterine cancer, vomiting during pregnancy, and blood clots of the veins, especially in the legs, that's known as venous thrombosis. This information doesn't take into account that there may be some effect from nicotine on an unborn baby, so in terms of vomiting during pregnancy, it's probably important to take that into account. Despite the possible positive effects, it's important to only take safe nicotine. The safest sources of nicotine include transdermal patches, that sticks to the skin through which the nicotine gets into the bloodstream, gum and lozenges. This works also, but the delivery isn't consistent and it's slower to show effects than some other methods. Inhalers and nasal spray, those are quick delivery, but the potential for addiction is there as well. Also, and these have become very popular, pouches, nicotine pouches. Nicotine pouches aren't chewing tobacco, they're oral, spit-free pouches that are placed similarly to it as well between the cheek and gum. While they aren't FDA approved as medical smoking cessation tools and still carry health risks, health experts recognize several practical and harm reduction benefits, particularly for adults transitioning away from combustible tobacco. For the rest, the data is actually pretty scarce. It's difficult to find hard proof of the benefits for other problems. Now, Michael, you mentioned growing tobacco, so I'll put on my State of Florida Certified Master Gardener hat and comment on this. Growing tobacco plants is pretty easy. It's similar to growing tomatoes or peppers, but curing, processing, and harvesting the leaves properly requires significant time and effort. Now, key factors for growing tobacco include germination and seedlings, of course. The tobacco seeds are tiny, must be started indoors 6 to 8 weeks before transplanting. They require warm temperatures, 70 to 85 degrees, and sunlight or grow light. Soil and light issues are important. Plants need full sun and well-draining soil with a pH between 5.8 and 6.2. To maintain them, they need regular watering, about an inch a week, constant pruning. You have to pinch off flower heads, topping them, in other words, and remove any side shoots or suckers to divert energy into these large, thick leaves that you want to produce. Remember that there are hornworms, aphids, flea beetles, they love tobacco, and handling wet green leaves can also cause something called green tobacco sickness, which is nicotine poisoning absorbed through the skin. So wearing gloves and long sleeves, good idea when working with the crop. The main challenge is curing and aging. While keeping the plants alive is simple, raw green tobacco cannot be used immediately. You have to air cure it. Harvested leaves have to hang in a warm, dark, well-ventilated space like a shed or barn for 4 to 8 weeks to dry and turn golden brown without rotting. They have to age. You have to break down the harsh ammonia and develop flavor or usable quality at least. Cured tobacco typically needs to age for several months to a year, so take this into account. I hope this helps. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies at AldenFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
Good stuff there. And I'll just say for you smokers, some alternative form of nicotine, if that's what it takes to get off smoking, please do it. Like, smoking is one of the leading killers in our country. And every time someone tries to defend it, what they end up defending is some of these positive aspects of nicotine. Well, the nicotine isn't what gives you lung cancer. The nicotine isn't what makes you stink. that nicotine isn't the thing that makes you have to leave a place because nobody wants you smoking around them, so you have to go way over there to do it. I'm not putting you down as a human. I'm telling you that you would be better off, be healthier, and have more money if you don't want to give up the nicotine, getting it a different way. Ah, soapbox put away. Let's move on and talk about log splitters. I sent this to a couple different people on the expert panel. That's why you'll see Carrie say it eventually made its way around to me. Everybody took a pass on this one. I have very limited experience with wood splitters. I do have a wood splitter that is completely manual, and no, it's not a mall. It's available from Harbor Freight. I'll tell you about it after you hear from Carrie and his advice on choosing one.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie here from Stronger Tree Sources. And today we're going to talk wood splitters, something a little different today, but the question made its way over to me, and I actually do have a fair amount of experience in all variety of decent to downright crappy wood splitters. I've been heating with wood for, well, I'd say going on 20 years now. I mean, grew up with it, although when we were little kids, we didn't really have to, we didn't have to split the wood. But the urban place, as soon as we discovered the cost of the heating bill in that old house, we put in a wood stove, and then, of course, our cabin has been heated by a wood stove here. So I cycle through quite a bit of wood. So Will wrote in. He said, I own a home that has a wood stove insert for supplemental heat. Last year, I burned about 2 cords of wood that came with the house, and I have about 2 cords left for this year, so it's time to start the next wood pile for next year. I don't plan on selling split wood, and I don't need anything that can be towed. The place where my wood currently is has no power out to it, and I am comfortable with some small engine maintenance to store it properly. And with that information, this one is actually going to be fairly easy. You don't need anything huge. You don't need anything super expensive, relatively speaking. So knowing what heat bills could run these days, a $1,000 splitter or so, or even up to a $1,500 or $1,700 splitter is going to take care of all your needs, and you are, of course, going to see those savings show up pretty quick. So I don't think you need to look at the big commercial ones. I mean, there's ones that are $5,000, $6,000. I saw one that Northern Tool sells is $11,000, and these are for guys that are obviously, you know, making a business out of this. These splitters, they're rated by tonnage. You'll see them, you know, 20 ton, 32 ton, and that's, you know, that's its capacity, that's its force. And so with just doing 2 cords a year, and that's something you can do, you know, you can do a little bit at a time and build up your stock. You don't have to wear yourself out spending hours and hours and days doing this. You don't necessarily need one that is has the fastest return either. So generally speaking, I would recommend something in the 25 to 28 ton class. I would probably not go under 22 tons, or you could end up having to, you know, miss out on splitting anything that's real, it's got a lot of knots in it, it's got a lot of irregularity, things like, locust, and hackberry can be very dense and very hard to split. So look at your gas hydraulic varieties. You can get them that will position both horizontally and vertically. So if you have a large round that you don't want to try to lift or roll, you can invert that machine and drop the wedge down, or drop the plate down from the top, and not have to wrestle all that wood. Definitely don't skimp on a decent sized wood cradle. That makes a huge difference. Even to the point where if you can get a really good deal on one, but it doesn't have a great cradle, see if you can buy one aftermarket, or if you can rig something up. Because just especially if you're doing it on your own, not having to keep a hand on that log to keep it from rolling off or popping off once the pressure starts to be applied. That's a super nice feature. Your engine is going to go, you're going to see them between about 200 and 225 cc's. Try to get a recognizable engine. The Hondas are great, of course, but the Briggs and Stratton, the Kohlers, those tend to, really hold out. And with, you know, your typical engine maintenance, oil, and that kind of thing. They will put on plenty of hours. Most of them have a two-stage hydraulic pump, the ones that are decent, and the cycle time is 10 to 15 seconds. So it tends to cycle forward slower and faster in reverse. And I'm personally not real worried about having one that's very fast, because while it's cycling back, I'm probably picking up the next log to position or whatever. So unless I've got, you know, a couple of people working with me and we're really just trying to blast through it, I'm not too worried about that extra 5 or 10 seconds. Being able to split a log that's at least, that's up to 24 inches long is nice, and that it has that full beam capacity, auto return, and the ones with wheels, I mean, even if you don't need to tow it, man, if you got a tree come down on your property somewhere and you do need to hook it up to your side-by-side or four-wheeler, or even if you're just pulling it in and out of your shop or your garage, the wheels are super nice. Make sure it does have the hydraulic filter. That's one of the ways of really extending the life of those pumps. And go ahead and look up if, you can identify those hydraulic parts and make sure you can get replacements, seals, fluid, the little things like that. The most common maintenance that happens on the one we have here on the farm is, you know, it's ancient, so it leaks a little bit of hydraulic oil. But it can all be rebuilt. In fact, it was originally my brother got it from some fella that just built it out of stuff. It's very, it's very basic, but it runs like a champ. Some of them will have like a four-way wedge, which is nice. So no matter how you position your log on there, it'll bust that log and, make sure it's, make sure it's got hydraulic oil when you get it. Sometimes they don't. And of course, engine oil and all that good stuff. So, probably round up maybe an extra $100, $150 for the potential accessories you might need to pick up for it. Let's see here. There's a little bit to know about running a splitter if you haven't already. Just like when you're hand splitting, which is what I pretend to do most of, but I go through so little wood, I can do a little bit of splitting with a maul just, 20 minutes at a time and generate quite a bit. And I actually like doing it. I'm kind of weird. I don't find it backbreaking. I find it very relaxing to hand split. But keep in mind, I'm hand splitting nothing over 1 foot in length because my stove is tiny. So I'm really just doing little chunks. But if you are, when you're lining up that log to, and it's going to be pushed towards the wedge, try to line it up with an existing crack. And I generally don't try to split wood unless it's already begun to season. I let my stuff season as rounds, depending on, where I find it, pick it up, where I harvest it from the farm. Let it season as rounds, let it start to show those cracks. And then I kind of line them up. So kind of go, just kind of like going with the grain. Think of it that way. It'll make a big difference. And also, for the sake of safety, this is a good time to have your ear protection and certainly your eye protection. And don't be standing off to either side of that wedge or if you have people helping you. Because some of that, even though there's a lot of tension hiding in that wood, and so as that ram is moving forward and getting ready to press it against the wedge, that wood can go flying. And I've been barked in the knees and the shins more times than I'd like to say by not being in the right spot. It can really go flying. So keep out, watch out for that. Bark can go fly. Bark will fly straight up. So, and you'll kind of learn over time as you're working with different kinds of wood, you'll notice that one type is a little more explosive, as it were, than other types. So those are just good things to kind of learn. And then, like anything else that has a gas engine in it, if you have to use ethanol, fuel that has ethanol in it, either keep it all the way full, especially because most of these have metal tanks, so they will condensate. Keep it all the way full while it's in season use, and when you're done with it, run it all the way empty, run the carb empty, and hit it with a little bit. If you're not using fuel stabilizer, use that too, and just kind of clean those little components out so you're not dealing with a gummed up carb the following season, because nobody likes doing that. Let me make sure I got my notes in front of me here. Make sure I've got everything to, where to get these. Northern Tool is actually one of my favorite. Northern Tool carries good brands, when it comes to the gas stuff. They generally have pretty good, warranties and such, and customer service and all that. But don't overlook, Facebook Marketplace and the used market and auctions and things like that, because you can easily find something that maybe somebody started a very brief firewood business, got more gear than they really needed. I saw one today. I saw a $6,500 heavy-duty commercial splitter that this guy had advertised for $1,600 in my area. So, you might be able to find something very durable and very lightly used on Marketplace, especially if you know how to work on an engine, you know how to kind of check out if it's been abused or not had not been well maintained. You can certainly retain some more cash. I really like the Champions. It looks like Champion has a 27 ton that is both horizontal and vertical, right at around 1400. DeWalt has a 28 ton, also horizontal and vertical, for around 1500. And that's just starters. There's plenty out there. Of course, the minute I started looking up the latest prices on log splitters, Instagram and Facebook wanted to show me every single ad. So there's a brand called Rugged Made. There's a brand called Brute Work. It was BRUT, I believe, that had a variety of kind of upgraded machines for people who like to have all kinds of extra little handy features on those machines. So, Will and everybody else, I hope that is helpful to you. It's hard to believe that we're already getting close to firewood season, because it's still 90 degrees here in Knoxville. But before long, we'll need to be doing that. So best of luck to you, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
So as I mentioned, I own a manual splitter that comes from Harbor Freight. It's very affordable. It's $129. When you use it, it's basically a 10-ton hydraulic jack on a horizontal I-beam with a big wedge on the opposite end from the jack. So you lay the log down on it, and then the jack has actually two handles, and you can either pull them both back and forth at the same time, or use it more like one of those walking calisthenic machines, or like a skiing machine, where you're using one at a time, and that seems to actually be a lot easier to do. And we've used it quite a bit. I haven't used it in years because I don't do a lot of log splitting anymore, because I don't have any indoor wood burning stuff. And for big outdoor fires, we just throw big giant logs on the fire and don't worry about it. I got it when we were in Arkansas, and we did use a lot of wood in Arkansas. It got a lot colder than it is here. We had a lot of wood available on the property, and it worked really well most of the time. Now, what Kerry talked about was how you get some of these, logs that have a lot of unusual grain, knotty stuff, really heavy stuff. No, it wasn't great for those, and those just, it won't work for. So who is this thing for? It's for somebody who needs to do some occasional wood splitting, goes through small amounts of wood. And most of your stuff is in pretty good shape and easy to split. And you just don't want to beat your ass down using a maul. It is great for that. We actually split a bunch of wood at one of our first workshops here, because once we got it out just to show people how it worked, and people were on it like an exerciser and enjoying themselves, so we let them go. Again, you will hit some stuff that it won't do well, but if you don't want to step all the way up to a mechanical one, and you do want to have a little bit of ease versus throwing something up on a log and hitting it with a mule maul, this might be the thing for you. So if you go to the show notes today, for episode 3898, right under Kerry's bullet point, you'll see manual splitter from Harbor Freight that Jack owns. That's the one I'm talking about. All right, so now let's get into my double segment today, because I got two things to tell you about. I want to start out with something that I think might help those of us in the boomer, Gen X, and older millennial cohort do a better job of explaining things to people that are in the younger millennial Gen Z cohort, and Gen Alpha will be coming into its own soon as well. And that is the difference between fault and responsibility. And this is something that I go into quite a bit in Laws of Life Book 2. But fault and responsibility are really muddying the waters, and I believe it is done through propaganda and by design of younger people today as part of class warfare. So what will often happen is a young person will make a declaration of something being really hard, and an older crusty Gen X like myself will say, but this is what you need to do. And what we think we're doing is offering them, and we are, right, but they don't hear it this way. From our mouth, we believe what we're saying is, listen, I understand things are hard, and I understand how tough it is, and what I'm going to tell you, though, is this is how you do something about it. And when you do this, maybe it won't fix everything magically, but your situation overall will improve. And by doing it consistently over time, you will find your way to some level of success like the people that you're looking at right now and wishing you could be like them. Okay. What they hear is, it's all your fault. All right. And you can say whatever you want about them. You can mock them, call them soft, whatever. But they have been conditioned to believe that you telling them it's their responsibility means that it's their fault. It does not. It's never what it meant. And there's a very simple way to separate the two concepts, fault and responsibility. Okay? And it is time. Fault is from 1 second ago in reverse. Anything that can be assigned as a fault, somebody else caused it to happen, or who caused it to happen? Because generally speaking, when somebody has a negative point in their life, it is seldom the case that it is only somebody else's fault. Usually the person themselves had some input, though how much is like a dimmer switch. In some instances, the situation they're dealing with may be 90% some other group or other entity's fault, and only 10% their own. They could have made better decisions, but the vast majority of the fault does lie with somebody else. In some systems, it might be 50-50. In some, it might be 75-80% their own fault and somewhat circumstantial for the rest. Okay? In some cases, it might be 100% somebody else's fault, and in some cases, it might be 100% their fault. It makes no difference in delineating between fault and responsibility because fault is in the past. It has to be because whatever caused it already occurred. That's fault. Okay, responsibility, when you tell a young person today, and not just young people, it's just more the case that it's true, but there's plenty of boomers that don't get this either, right? When you say this is your responsibility, you need to do these things to improve your system, what they just heard is it's all your fault. But responsibility is from the present forward. That's the delineation point. Responsibility is from the present forward, and it doesn't matter whose fault it is. It doesn't matter if you're right. It doesn't matter if you're a pure victim. It's still your responsibility. Go take a firearms training course, a good one, right? Like a tactical response. Right? Or something like that. You're going to probably see somewhere in a classroom, at a range, etc., a sign that will say something like, everything is your responsibility, or everything is my responsibility. Why? Because it is. So let's look at a scenario that involves a concealed handgun carrier to understand this and how it applies to everything. You go to a restaurant. You're minding your own business. You're carrying a gun. Right? You didn't do anything wrong. In fact, you did everything right. You positioned yourself away from the major entrances and exits with your back to a wall so that you can observe. You identified exits and entrances. You do all the things that most of us prior military people or people with training or law enforcement people do. And comes a maniac. He comes in and just starts shooting the place up. Is anything that happened at this point your fault? No. Is your survival and the survival around of others around you now your responsibility? Yes. Is it fair? Yes. I mean, I'm sorry. No. Does it matter? No. Doesn't matter that it's not fair. It doesn't matter 1/10 of 1/1000th of 1% that it's not fair when it comes to the responsibility aspect of it. You now have to make decisions that will cost lives or save lives. It's not fair. It's not your fault. But it became your responsibility when you decided to carry a weapon and when you decided that it was your responsibility to take care of yourself and other people. See how simple that is? Okay, now do it with anything. You're broke. Doesn't matter why. Your responsibility. You want to buy a house and you can't. Doesn't matter whose fault it is. It doesn't matter they changed the money in 1971 and effed everything up. It doesn't matter that Trump spent a bunch of money on war. It doesn't matter what Biden did before him or Obama did before that. It doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter what interest rates are. It doesn't matter who the Federal Reserve Chairman is. It doesn't matter that your bank is a poo-poo head. Your banker's a poo-poo head or whatever, right? All that matters is your responsibility. And keep going. Student loan debt? Doesn't matter how you were tricked into it. It's your responsibility. Substance abuse problem? Doesn't matter how hard it is to get off it. It's your responsibility. It doesn't mean you can't look for help. It doesn't mean you can't leverage assistance. It doesn't mean you can't do things and ask others to aid you in getting past the problem. But it comes down to it is on your shoulders and on your back, and it is your responsibility, and it begins the second you identify the problem forward. And everything in the past is fault, and everything forward is responsibility. If we could just get that into the minds of the average American, we would transform this country in a positive way for generations. That one simple concept, fault lies in the past, responsibility lies in the present forward. When you're talking to younger people, especially you guys that are like my age and older, right, or a little bit younger than me, but, you know, in my same generational cohort, when you're talking to young people, that's the way to explain it. That's the way to explain it, maybe a little softer than I just did, but it doesn't matter whose fault it is, you're responsible for it. Fault is in the past, responsibility is in the future. If you can draw that line in your mind, then you can stop expecting that someone else will fix it, because no one else is going to fix it. We're going to get a new president, and they're going to balance the budget. Yeah, you know how long ago I heard that? Freaking Jimmy Carter was president. Hello. Did it happen? No. Did anybody ever do it? No. But Bill Clinton, no, he did not. It was voodoo economics, and it did not work. Voodoo economics were not just the realm of Bush Sr. If Bill Clinton would have served a third term, the economy would have looked a lot like it did under Bush II. I'm telling you, this is mathematical. And it doesn't even matter if it's not. It doesn't even matter if I'm wrong. You still live in this place in time. You live in this space-time, continuum of now, and you have to deal with it. All right, moving on. I want to tell you about something else I'm going to be doing. So I went to a three-day-a-week schedule for, a month and a half, and went, that doesn't work. But I've been doing four shows a week for over a year now, and that does work. But yet we're going back to five. But it's because I have something I want to do. I want to bring more information to you, but I don't want to sit down and spend 3 hours a day, 3 hours on Friday, producing a new show for you. Because that's 3 to 4 hours to produce a show is minimum. Some of the shows, like I'm working on them for a week before I do them. Okay? So there's somewhere between 3 to 4 hours to like 12 to 16 hours to produce an episode, depending on what episode it is. I want to do that on Friday. I also love AI and the power and the leverage of AI. And I've been doing something for myself for a long time, and I want to start doing it for you guys because I can multitask. Function stack, right? So what I do is I use a tool that's called Gemini Notebook, formerly known as Notebook LM, and it's still really both things, but Google's trying to consolidate all their AI under the Gemini brand. And Notebook LM was originally developed specifically for students, really targeted toward college students, and it is an AI product that came out of Google through their really cool policy. I don't love Google, but I love some of the things about them. And they have one really cool policy that I think all tech companies should do. There's a certain amount of time, I don't remember what percentage of the work week it is, but there's a certain amount of time that any Google employee can work on anything that they want. Under the understanding is being, you know, they're being paid for it, so it's you're building it for Google, but you can come up with an idea, talk to some of your coworkers and say, hey, let's build the thing, and they just let you go do it. No one's on your ass about, hey, you're supposed to get your TPS reports in. Why are you doing this? You get this certain amount of time every week that you can work on a thing. And that's where Notebook came from. And the idea was that we could take things like PDFs of textbooks, or reading assignments, etc., research assignments, and we could drop that in there, and then it would change the format that we consume the information in. So they created these two AI entities, a male and a female, that basically create a podcast version, a discussion, and it can be short, it can be long, it can be a debate, it can be a critique. It's really cool. But then they added all this other stuff. You can make presenter slides from data, like a PowerPoint presentation, either for student review or to present a project. There's quizzes, there's videos even. You can create explainer videos or cinematic videos, and you can do a lot with prompting. And that's something that really wasn't very effective when it first came out, but it's gotten highly effective. And if you use really precise prompting, you can create really precise results. And I've gotten over the last 3 years really badass at prompting. And I've also been able to use the prompting that I use with entities like ChatGPT to develop better prompting for Notebook LM, like using the CRIT formula and saying, how can I take this and make this better? And one of the real magic components of this with Notebook is to create personas for the virtual hosts. And so you might have something, let's say if you were doing a critique on or a podcast on one of the chapters of my book at Being on Time, you might have like a tech bro who's kind of casual and like, I don't care about time so much as I do about, you know, the work getting done properly. And then you might have the other host be somebody like a retired military officer to which you're allergic to being late. And when somebody says, what happens when people are late? You instinctively respond, people die. And everybody looks at you like you're crazy and says, what's wrong with you? Or any kind of juxtaposition that you can come up with. Maybe you do something with like a neuroscientist and a psychologist, for example. And with that level of precision in your prompting, you can create very interesting discussions. Now, there's a lot of stuff that I want to know more about that I don't have the time to sit down and read. But I do have the time, like when I'm working out in the mornings and taking care of like my physical workouts, or I'm outside working on things like my aquatic systems or whatever. And I have, like, when you add all that up, over an hour, I can listen to podcasts. So what I've done over all this time is when I want to know more about something, I create this for myself and then I listen to it with the Notebook app. I've also seen people take Notebook LM, develop podcasts, and put them out on podcast services like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. They generally don't go very well. One, because they're sloppy prompters, but two, they put that out like it's actually real, and then people listen to it and go, I've heard this shit before, and they turn it off. I'm coming up with something called Friday Fusions. And Friday Fusions is my input combined with this AI with a introduction in my own voice, which will probably be pretty stock and repeated, but it is me, that says what it is, that warns you about things like it can be wrong or it might mispronounce something and you should verify before you act, and says, I'm Jack Spirko and it's from the Survival Podcast and this is a supplemental. And some other things that are in the intro. And if you start listening to Fusions after the second or third one, you'll probably skip past that. But I got to put it in there and cover all those bases for the person that finds that one episode and they have no idea what it is. I don't want them just dumped into virtual voice. I want them to understand that I've put the extra effort into doing this. These podcasts will also be published with full show notes like I do. Maybe not as elaborate as my typical show notes, but things like, if they're in the first series we're doing, is on Lost Tropes of the Incas. I've obtained a PDF of it. I'll tell you more about that in a second. And I am building a series of Friday Fusions with that PDF. And the first one will be out tomorrow. And it covers all the tubers in Lost Tropes of the Incas. It's a publication put out in 1989. Buying a copy of the book's like $130 because it's out of print. But it's available on like Internet Archive and things like that. So what I'm doing is each week until we run out of things in there, like the week one will be tubers, week two will be grains, right? Like that. And week three is like legumes and week four is fruits. I think that's how it goes if I remember right. And each one of those will, so when I do those, all of the plants will be listed in bullet points in the show notes. So if you don't understand how they're pronouncing something or whatever, you can look up and learn more about it. So I think this is going to be really cool. In fact, the graphic that I developed, is it's got me on, and it's like literally me transmitting information to AI, and then AI takes the information and transmits it to you. It is a fusion of human and machine intelligence, and without the prompting that I do, it would not be what it is. And I created the first episode today, and I listened to it already, and it was pretty damn good. It qualified for me to use for myself so I can learn more, so I can absorb this information. And I did it from like an anthropologist and a botanist having this discussion, right? And talking about how it would affect agricultural crops, how it could be used in backyards, fairly elaborate prompting. But now that I have something big to work on, I can basically make very short modifications to that prompt, and I can make 4 episodes out of this one thing. This is the other thing I'm going to do. I'm going to make the source material in the show notes available so you can reiterate any of this stuff yourself or use it to create any collateral material that you want. I'm not going to give away my prompts. That's my secret sauce, okay? But I'll give you the source material. And sometimes that'll mean that I had to pull some tricks of my own to be able to use it. Example, it was pretty easy to find a PDF of this publication. The PDF was in print. In image. It was a scan. There was something about it, like a buggy, when you tried to upload it to Notebook LM, it didn't work. I converted it to text using, you know, just Mac functionality on a MacBook, and then it didn't work either. So I gave it to ChatGPT, which was able to review it, and had it put out a pure text copy that then I could upload to Notebook, and it worked. Without that, you couldn't do it. So if there's anything like that, I'll include not only the source files, but the conversions for you. So this can be a learning tool as in just listen and learn, or it can be a learning tool as in active participation in creating your own versions. Because I do believe that we need to learn to do these things. We need to learn how to set things up where humans and artificial intelligence can work together and combine the output to make something that neither could do on their own. So that's what's coming with Friday Fusions. And again, the first series, Lost Crops of the Incas, will run through September. And I think when you listen to it, if right now you're skeptical, if you give it a listen tomorrow when it comes out, you'll see what I mean. All right, with that, guys, I am ready to wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. Quick reminders again, the AI Choose a Business course launches Monday morning, 9 a.m. Central. Stay tuned for that. Opt in, learn more about it. You can go to jackslaws.com, learn more about that. And the TSP 26 workshop goes on sale next Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Central. Don't miss that, because if you miss it, you're not going to get in. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with a Friday Fusion.
They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. Better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way. Revolution.